This is episode number 25 with Craig Dixon, co-founder and general partner of Accelerating Asia. Welcome to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. My name is Andrew Senduk, a former banker turned tech entrepreneur. And in each episode, I interview the movers and shakers of the venture capital and investment space in Southeast Asia, with the only goal to help you discover how to raise more capital, build better companies, and to give you a better understanding of the people behind the biggest funds in the region. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. Now let's get started. All right, beautiful people, welcome to a new day. The sun is shining, and I'm happy that today I am with Craig Dixon. We've set this up through LinkedIn. I think we were messaging back and forth, and I'm excited to have you on the show, Craig. Craig originally started his career within the investment banking for big names like Citi and Bank of America Merrill Lynch. After that, you co-founded Zumata Technologies, which eventually was acquired by Rakuten. And then you became entrepreneur in residence for Muru. And now you are the co-founder and GP of Accelerating Asia, which is an early stage VC fund. And recently you guys launched a fund number two, $20 million fund, which is exciting and love to hear more about it. And I want to highlight one thing. I was reading the why of Accelerating Asia, and I think the why really resonates with me. But I think if you're an entrepreneur, you would also love this. The why of Accelerating Asia is entrepreneurs are one of humanity's greatest catalysts for positive change. Craig, happy to have you on the show. How are you doing?
Really great to be here. Sun's also shining here, although a little bit of clouds. And I'm based in Singapore, and I always say my favorite Singapore weather is cloudy, no rain, because I can go around without getting sunburned.
Yeah,
but still, but not get rained on and soaked. So it's a good day. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, super excited to have you on. And congrats on fund number two. Super exciting. How has fundraising been for you guys? I mean, we always talk about startups wanting to fundraise, but you guys also need to put in the work. Like, how's it been?
Yeah, it's funny because when I was a founder, I don't think I really understood the dynamics of how VC funding works. And I just figured, oh, they have a bunch of money and they give startups money and it's an easy job. And, of course, I later realized that VCs are out fundraising at least half the time and they're sourcing deals the other half of the time and managing a portfolio, whatever percent is left on that. So it's a really positive environment right now. Having said that, there's so many new funds springing up left and right.
So
there's a lot of people out fundraising too. I think, I guess we've learned a lot over the past few years of running Accelerating Asia about how the dynamics of this work, and we've learned where we fit into the market and therefore what types of LPs or what profile of LPs are a good fit for us. And that's really made things so much more efficient from a fundraising process. And so I think, the two things on that side, number one is that we are kind of a seed stage or pre-series A is where we come in. And so certain LPs are going to be more, hey, we're looking for series A's or B's or C's. We obviously are seeking more LPs that are looking at the earlier stage investments. And then I guess another aspect to it, which we don't lead with, we're not an impact investor or an impact accelerator, but because of where we do business and where we invest and accelerate our startups, we do typically qualify as an impact investment. And so a number of our larger LPs are actually NGOs or impact focused organizations that are looking for ways to support startup ecosystems in kind of emerging economies and also support business models that are covering, one or more of the SDGs. So that's been something that we kind of iterated on and learned by doing through Fund One.
That's amazing. And how has it been? I mean, I always love the transition, being an entrepreneur itself, being acquired, then moving into, an entrepreneur in residence, which is, I always love to explain it in a way or describe it in a way where you're actually already in a nicely built house, so to say, but you can still do your entrepreneurial stuff. But then launching your own fund, which is a different type of game, right? How has that journey been, even from the early days of banking and moving towards entrepreneuring, and now eventually becoming a GP of a fund? Like, what's been the highlights and the choices that you've made along the way?
I think the biggest shock for me in retrospect is going from banking to startups. And you probably you know, you have a background doing this as well. I mean, the brain training and the day-to-day ops is so completely different, where when I'm at a bank, I'm completely focused on one specific aspect of the business. And if I need anything else done, I just tell somebody else to do it. Right. So, you know, if the printer breaks, somebody go fix the printer. If I need this delivered somewhere, somebody go deliver this.
Yeah.
Like, I don't do anything except my stuff. Right. And then you become a founder and you do everything. Like, the printer breaks, you fix it, you got to deliver something, you know, go do it. So I think, and then the thinking around iterating and just developing an MVP and launching it and getting customer feedback and stuff is brand new. So that was the biggest shock for me. I think going from founder to EIR was really easy because I basically moved into I was running a corporate accelerator. I was getting paid a corporate salary and I got to just mentor startups who are earlier stage than me. Now, it did take time for me to really get better at it, but I think I already had the experience. And so it was fairly easy for me to kind of jump into that role. And then pivoting from EIR to what I do now, which is, we're an accelerator and a VC fund. So we're a little bit different from most VCs. We're more like a Y Combinator or a Techstars or something, right? And and so it's even more complicated because we have an accelerator program and we have a venture capital fund. And so we're actually running two businesses at the same time. Obviously there's overlap, but they're quite different. And I'm a founder again. So I'm an owner of this business that's doing this. It's easier in the sense, or it's less risky in the sense that my whole business is diversified by the multiple investments we make. Whereas when you're a founder, it's kind of like all or nothing, right? You know, there's no diversification when you're a founder, right? Like your business like is to the moon or whatever that is exit or whatever, or it fails. And not that my business, it's not like it can't fail, but we're much more protected and much more diversified. And so to some extent it's different in that way, but I think from a difficulty and a scaling, getting people to buy into your business, getting people to invest in the first fund was so similar to fundraising for my startup. But I think what's helped me with this, especially as I focus a lot more on the fund side, as much as the accelerator side, is my wealth management experience and my banking experience is really helpful because our investors are almost the same type of profile as my clients were at the big banks. That's been really helpful. So now I'm basically a kind of a wealth manager in some respects because I'm helping people invest into micro cap, startups in South and Southeast. That's an interesting overlap. And then the founder stuff really helps me to build this business and scale this business. And so it all kind of comes together. If you go from corporate to startups, it's a real big shock and you got to retrain your brain. Your research first. I just jumped head first and that was not the right way to do it.
it's interesting. I did the same thing. I actually, back then I actually resigned. So I was working at a dealing room back then and I just resigned my job. I just resigned. And then I started my own, which was kind of like a shock, right? But I love what you said. So your, let's say the LP profile is very similar to the high net worth individuals that you've worked with in your banking days. But oftentimes when we talk about LPs, when we talk about the investors behind a fund, it's a lot about Rolodex, right? It's a lot about your network within the region. The people with deep pockets and that are maybe just looking for a different asset class. How was it for you? I mean, you've been in Southeast Asia. We were just talking about it for 10 years ish, right? How was it for you? Because yes, you have your network in the US of the high net worth individuals. To build that again from scratch here, even though the profile would be the same, but you're still a quote unquote new guy in the scene, right? So how was that to knock on those doors and eventually convince people to back this idea?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think we were really lucky that the Muru experience actually flowed right into Accelerating Asia. So for those that don't know, Muru, it was called Muru D. Muru D was a startup accelerator backed by Telstra, the Australian telco.
Got it.
But I was my co-founder of Accelerating Asia, Amr, and I were running the Singapore version of that. And so they had kind of a program before I got there, and they had investors that were coming in to look at our portfolio companies. And, you know, I worked with some of the other EIRs around the world in that program to make some tweaks to the program. And that ended up being quite successful. And so in our final cohort, we had two startups get into the first Sequoia Surge batch, for instance. And we had a lot of follow-ons. We had a successful exit and things actually went pretty well. And so when we pivoted to accelerating Asia and Telstra decided to shut that program down, we had this whole network of our alumni founders from that program, the investors who had been engaging through that network that we were able to port over. And so, you know, we were really lucky that we didn't have to start from scratch. And the majority of our LPs in the first fund were actually people that we had had known and built relationships with through the Muru program. And they knew, you know, Craig and Amr know how to run an accelerator. They know how to attract quality founders and help them scale up. And they can, and they're, you know, they're a good source to get access to quality startups at an early stage that we can then invest in. And so that was, I'm not saying it was easy, but we had kind of a head start and we're just very lucky to have that. And what I would compare it to as a founder would be like a founder who is at a company and starts a business that solves a problem they have at their business, for instance. Yeah. So it's like you already have like a perfect use case of like the need, the value proposition, potentially a customer, but if it's not that company, there's other companies. And so when you hit the ground running on a startup like that, you're already just, you have so many advantages. You're 6 months ahead of somebody, maybe like you and me, who just jump in and they're just like, okay, like let's do a startup.
Yeah. Such a good point. I think even from a network perspective where, let's say there's a pattern of your similar clients in the US that you've worked with in your banking days to the people that you've worked with as an entrepreneur in residence, you know, where you're running the accelerator there. So it kind of like organically then moved into accelerating Asia, if I'm correct, right? I mean, even the whole career has been kind of like organically moving towards that direction.
I mean, it's nice to say that and make it seem like, you know, it was meant to be.
It's all planned out.
Yeah, the reality is always really messy. And, you know, what happened was Telstra was having its own internal challenges and they decided to reprioritize on their core business. And that's fair enough. And so they decided they're going to close the global startup thing. And Amr and I were like, this thing is working so well.
Yeah.
Obviously, for Telstra, it doesn't make sense, but this makes sense here in Singapore. And so we have this advantage, we have this network, we have all these pieces that we can take.
Yeah.
And so it was very, it seemed logical to me that we would try. And we're still the only accelerator I know of in the region that is independent and focused on this kind of pre-series A profile of founder.
Yeah.
And I think there's still a big gap there for a lot of these founders who get past the initial MVP stage or get their first customers, but they're not yet ready for those $1 million plus checks.
Yeah.
And it's like a no man's land for these founders. And I experienced that as a founder where I'm like, oh, I can't take $1 million valuation from this accelerator, but the VCs aren't writing me a check yet.
Yeah.
And I'm like making all these mistakes and trying to feel my way around. And so our program is really suited towards helping those founders to get to that $1 million plus check much faster and more efficiently with less risk to their business. And I just saw a gap there and a nice product market fit that we'd already experienced.
Yeah.
And now there was a gap because Meridi was gone. Let's do it ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I think at the end of the day for the whole ecosystem, sometimes we get so caught up with these headlines and we see fundraising here and there, but at the end of the day, it is about just growing your business. It's scaling it to the next level, getting the right, you know, product market fit, getting the right demand, you know, like the really scaling demand for your product or services. So I think that's a really good market that you're focusing on. And let's talk more because you mentioned something very crucial where you say like, okay, accelerating Asia, there are actually two businesses, right? One is a fund, which is like a just pure investments, but the other one is actually the accelerating part. Can you share more about, let's say, the profile of startups that are entering the accelerating program and also how you manage the, let's say, the VC part of the business?
Yeah. So the profile of startups that come in are typically they have a product in market, they have revenue. The revenue is typically from, you know, $1,000 a month up to even, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a month in some cases. They've typically been doing this for 6 to 24 months.
Yeah.
And they have the team required to execute on the business in the short to medium terms. That's like the next 12 to 18 months. They have everything they need to do to scale. We have startups across South and Southeast Asia. So we do have startups in Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, and then Southeast Asia, of course, is where the majority of our investments are. Mm-hmm. The accelerator takes in around 10 startups per batch twice a year. Okay. And for the cohort that just started, we had about 550 applications. We selected 10 startups. And every startup that gets in gets an initial check of $100,000. And then we use the program itself to understand who are the startups within each cohort that are doing the best.
Yeah.
Those get more money. And that could be another 100K or 200K.
Got it.
And then we have money also for following on after that and like pro rata and whatnot. So that's kind of how the fund, you know, distributes cash.
Yeah.
And how that coordinates with the accelerator program from an investment perspective and a selection perspective and a little bit of a profile. We do lean pretty heavy B2B, but we have some B2C. And I think the program is, you know, general enough that it can apply to any business model. But what we do is we identify the startups that get into each batch and we run you through a program. And the beginning of the program is fairly set. So we go through like fundraising and governance and, you know, a lot of the basics around SEO and product market fit. But then as we learn more about each of the startups individually and the cohort as a whole, we start to bring in customized assistance from outside that's more applicable to what the cohort needs.
Got it.
And then we have a huge Rolodex, as you talked about Rolodexes, of mentors.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we'll bring in mentors that are applicable to your vertical or your business model or your geography.
Yeah.
That can help you on those things that maybe the generalized program isn't equipped to handle.
That's really good. That's really good. And so that means that the VC fund itself is always linked to the accelerator applicants, or is the VC fund also investing on itself in other startups?
At the moment, it's not. So at the moment, it's only investing in startups that go through the accelerator. But we don't have a limitation on investing outside, but we haven't done so yet.
Got it. And I think from a risk perspective, it makes much more sense to kind of like control it in some way, like what you're investing in, how you're scaling that. So if we go a level deeper, right? Because to scale a business, even if you're running, I don't know, let's say $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a month in revenue, to bring it really to like 100 grand or 200 grand and up, the question would be like, is there a golden formula? Is there a golden formula to bring a company from, you know, let's say a level of, let's say 10K a month, right? And you need, because they come into the accelerator program with the desire or the expectation that, you know, after these couple of months we are together, the company is not going 10K a month, but we're going to be at, let's say 100K a month. And we're really going to be ready to raise like a quote unquote big round that's going to help this business to the next level. What is, in your opinion, the blueprint or the framework that you're using now to help these companies towards point B?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wouldn't say there's a magic formula, but we do have kind of a standard process that we can maybe generalize across a lot of the startups in our portfolio. I'd say a lot of these founders have kind of hustled their way to growth, which is great, but it's not usually so efficient. And there's usually some low-hanging fruit on both growing the business as well as closing investment. And these are both important, as you know. Obviously, the more efficient your growth is, the easier it is to grow with less resources. So that's number one. Mm. And I can dig into details there. And number two is, if you're able to efficiently raise cash, then you can invest in resources to grow the business, right? And so, you know, one thing I always say is, if you're out selling equity, you're not selling product. And so if you're out pitching all day long, you're not getting new customers and you're not selling a product. And therefore, you get into a negative feedback loop where your growth is lower because you're spending too much time fundraising, but the investors won't invest because your growth is too slow.
Yeah.
And so what we do is we completely reverse that flywheel and we say, okay, number one, we're going to help you grow more efficiently because we'll look at churn. We'll look at how to be more efficient with targeting customers learn customer profiling. Who are your super users? How do you get more of those?
Yeah.
How do you lower your churn? A lot of these folks come in with leaky buckets on the funnel, and I'm using some kind of jargon.
Yeah.
And then on the fundraising side, we focus a lot on communication. How can you effectively communicate your business so that it's more likely to be receptive to investors? And that's like pitch decks, verbal communication.
Yeah.
And a lot of times startups are missing key important aspects of their business that they're not communicating. And one example is we had a startup come in, I think last cohort. At the beginning of the program, they couldn't raise any money. Nobody would invest in them. And then we started working on their pitch, and I realized they had a network effect and they weren't talking about it. They hadn't fully deployed it yet. But I was like, okay, you have a great business, you have great founders, you have good early traction. But once you turn this on, this is like unicorn level stuff if you can execute on this. And so we started doing some testing on it, and we started communicating that into the pitch deck and building that in there. And by the end of the program, they had 3 term sheets from tier one VCs, including one of the most well VCs in the world, which they took investment from.
Wow.
And their valuation from $3 million to $10 million in 6 months.
That's crazy. It also shows a bit on, you know, sometimes we're so, I mean, as entrepreneurs, you're so deep into it, right? That you don't really see like the macro picture or how to position something. Because maybe if you just, you know, tweak it like a bit like this, or you highlight a different element of the business, and suddenly, you know, the eyes of the investors will say like, oh, okay, that's how it works.
Yeah. Just really quickly, because I think you're making a good point there, and I want to maybe double down on that a little bit. One thing I notice is a lot of founders, because they're head down in the product all day, all they want to talk about is the product.
Mm.
But an investor doesn't actually care that much about the product.
Yeah, totally.
They care about the result and the customer.
Mm.
And so I have this thing where I'm like, here's 2 examples. There's a founder who just talks about how amazing their product is for 10 slides. And it is an amazing product. And there's a founder who doesn't say even what their product is, but they go, you know what? We have $1 million of revenue in the past 6 months. We have an NPS of 9. And here's our retention rate.
Yeah.
And the investor's going to invest in the second one, even though he has no idea. Is it B2B? Is it B2C? Is it gum? Is it software? I don't even know. I'm investing in that one.
Yeah. So true. So true. And I think
that's an example. But, you know.
Yeah. That ability to zoom in and zoom out, depending on who you're talking to, I think that's a very, very important skill. It's an important skill to know, like, when do I need to zoom in? When do I need to zoom out to eventually, you know, bring the company, whether it's fundraising or whether it's growth, whatever it is, to bring it forward. You mentioned something really, really crucial on growth efficiency. And I'd love to hear your thoughts, like, you know, the rules or the frameworks that you apply to make sure that this batch, let's say the cohort number one of this year, to make sure that these guys are growing efficiently. What's kind of like your thoughts about that, and how can you make sure that all these companies within the cohort are growing efficiently, you know, and that they're not that, you know, we talk about tofu or mofu or bofu, like a top of the funnel or middle of the funnel, like that there's no leaks in the funnels, which is an extremely, extremely good point.
I think, you know, 101 of this is really understanding what the profile of customer or potential customer that has the biggest need for your product today.
Mm.
Learning that and building up those profiles over time, and then turning your business development into a machine that just goes after more of those people.
Yeah.
I think many startups, it's like growth at all costs. It's like, I'll sell to anybody.
Mm.
And the problem is you might get an initial sale, but because your product is not well matched to that customer, they're going to churn out and leave.
Yeah.
And then what might be even worse about that is your data on this heterogeneous user group is unusable. You can't do much with it.
Yeah.
Right. And so what you want to do is you want to say, okay, here's the group that we think is going, this is Peter Thiel 0 to 1. Mm. Where's your tiny monopoly of user group that has the highest need for your product today? When your product is kind of crap, you know, it's okay, but it's not where it's going to be in a year or two. Who's still going to say, I need that. I will pay for it.
Yeah.
Who is that?
Yeah.
And do some hypothesis testing around that. And if you're right, then turn that into a marketing machine and get more of those people. They will love it. They will tell their friends. Hmm. Your NPS will be off the charts. Your CLTV will be huge compared to your CAC, customer acquisition cost. And then you need to find the next customer profile who's ancillary to that one, but fairly similar. And that's your Peter Thiel next circle, if whoever's read that book, and everyone should.
Yeah.
That's the growth strategy. And too many startups are just like, who wants to buy my product? Here it is. Come in. Everyone's welcome. It's a big tent.
Yeah.
And you might get a short-term blip or even a longer-term blip, but over time your funnel gets leaky. Everything's efficient. And somebody who does the focused version is going to just pass you by.
Yeah. Yeah. And don't you think that one of the reasons that a lot of startups are so, let's say, top line focused is because just the whole wild, wild west type of ecosystem that we're in, and that they're all trying to be the next unicorn. They're all trying to be, I'm going to also raise a Series A of 100 million. But they're so focused on those, actually not very important, the North Stars. They should be focusing on, or have more patience. Maybe that's it. They should have more patience, give themselves more time to really dig down into their product market fit, so that eventually, on a longer term, they can get those better North
Stars. Yeah, I think I agree with all that. I also think, you know, in the Valley, this isn't as much of a problem because everybody already knows this stuff and they know kind of the toolkit. But in this region, we're not there yet. We're moving very fast and things have come a long way. But another problem I see at the early stages for both founders and investors is you have a bunch of founders who don't really know, you know, what they're doing. And I didn't either. I don't want to, you know, knock down anybody. I had no clue what I was doing and I learned the hard way. And somehow, you know, I did okay. But the investors don't know what they're doing either. And so I think sometimes you get like this false sense of confidence where you get like, you know, you make your first $1,000 and some angels are like, oh, here's 500K. And you're like, oh, I'm on the right track. Let's just keep it doing more of this and scale. Yeah. And then the VCs come in that they pass and they pass again. And you're like, why are all the VCs passing? Hmm. And the VCs often don't want to give you direct feedback. And so you don't learn. And it's a very inefficient thing. And so one thing we do, we're very direct with feedback, and the culture in our organization is, you know, we're very constructive. We're obviously on your side. We're investors and, you know, we have a stake in your business, but there's no beating around the bush. It's like, this is broken. You got to fix this or you're screwed.
Screwed. Yeah. It's very hands-on. Right.
We need more of that.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I think there's like the vanity metrics without quality control checks. And so it's fine to have North Star metrics, but most people have North Star metrics like revenue or number of users, and you don't have a quality control third North Star metric, which is what's your churn rate? What's your rolling churn rate?
Yeah.
Rolling number of new users and rolling number of churn rate should be the quality control on that North Star metric, right?
Yeah.
Vanity metrics or, you know, number of app downloads. Yeah. It's like, who cares?
Yeah.
How many people are using it? How many people are re-upping, you know, what's your average session time if you're a B2C
so true. And regarding that, right, when you say like, okay, the Valley, in the Valley, these things are like, you know, common knowledge, like everyone already knows, but the ecosystem here is of course much younger. There's so much more to learn and to build. And especially with Accelerating Asia, you guys are of course within that segment where everything is new, right? Everything is new. So what you're doing, I think, is really amazing because you're really equipping these startups, right? To learn more and look differently to numbers. What is also a thing with early stage is that the numbers oftentimes are not as detailed or not as big as, you know, later stage startups, meaning that a lot of your decisions will be based on non-metric data. How do you deal with that, and how do you make sure that you know, I think that the trust element, the trust that you have, you know, in before investing is there? Like, what's kind of like the what are the steps that you take to eventually, you know, come to a decision, you know, we're going to invest in these guys and we're going to take them into the cohort?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Obviously at the early stages of investing, there's a lot of qualitative aspects that come into play on your selection. One thing that makes it easier for us, excuse me, is the majority of the startups that actually get into our batches are referred in by our network. And so alumni, LPs, other VCs who might, you know, not be ready yet, but think if they go through our program, it might get them there. And obviously that's a buy-in. That's a double buy-in. It's a buy-in, obviously, that we get a referral from somebody, and it's a buy-in for the startup founder to say, oh, this person I trust believes this is a good option for me, right? So So a lot of our best startups come that way. That's a bit of a cheat though. On the ones that don't come through referrals, we've kind of built up a knowledge set of qualitative behaviors or characteristics of founders that seem to point towards success. And you know, one of those for me is knowing your metrics backwards and forwards. And so, you know, whatever your North Star metrics, what were they 3 months ago and 6 months ago? What are they today? What will they be in 3 months, 6 months from now, and why? What are like the levers of your business that, you know, when what you, if you're fundraising, what are you fundraising for and what are you going to do with it? And where does that get you? You know, a template we use for pitching is, you know, I'm raising $500,000. That will allow us to do X, Y, and Z, which will raise our monthly revenue from $10,000 to $25,000 over the next 6 months, at which point we will launch a Series A at a valuation that will be approximately double the valuation we're raising right now. And so that's like, okay, I'm raising so much money. Why? A lot of founders don't even know why. They're just like, oh, I just need $500,000. Because I think that's what I should be raising.
Everyone does that.
So what are you raising? What are you going to do with it? What levers does that pull to raise your revenue and other, it doesn't have to be just revenue. It could be your CLTV and lowering your CAC or whatever it is. And then where does that get you from a valuation perspective? Because the last part of what I said tells the investor, I'm going to double your money in 6 months or whatever.
Exactly.
I promise, but it's like, hey, come in at 3 million. I'm going to be 8 million in 9 months. Right. And then the investor's like, can see where this is going. Otherwise he's just like, hey, give me money and I'll turn it into more money. Hopefully, you know?
It's so true. It's so true. And what you said actually brings me to a good point, right? Where at the end of the day, you know, you're running a fund and the LPs, they say like, okay, what should we invest in? We can invest in like capital markets. We can invest in like real estate. Let's try this asset class. A bit risky. Don't always know what I'm investing in, but I think it's interesting. But as long as it gives me a good ROI, you know, then I'm fine with it. How do you deal with that? Like, how do you deal with balancing the needs of the LP, which, you know, bottom line would be like, oh, just give me a higher ROI than on my real estate, versus quality growth, building quality companies, and really helping these entrepreneurs being the catalyst, you know, of a brighter future and a better world, because these two needs are not per definition the same, I would say. But you know, love to hear your thoughts about it.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, first of all, we have different LPs that have different profiles and different expectations for what they're looking for, right? So we have, you know, we have some impact LPs, and they're more, you know, how many high quality jobs are you creating in a developing country? Yeah. How many women are you helping? And things like that. So upskilling and basically generally, you know, raising the bottom of the pyramid or the bottom two thirds of the pyramid. So that's one profile.
Yeah.
Another profile that is quite common amongst our LPs is individuals. So high net worth individuals who are looking to get into startups. They often like to mentor as much as invest.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Many of them are looking to eventually in the next 5 or 10 years leave their career and retire, and building an angel investment portfolio is both a passion and an investment strategy, right?
Yeah.
We have a lot of those, and we're a perfect match for those because we bring them high quality startups, but we also have the you know, we can give them a safe note template that they can use to invest, and we can coach them or answer their questions. And so that's kind of an education plus diversification strategy. So that's another one. And then we have just the pure financial folks. So we have people that are literally just like, hey, I'm looking for exposure to microcap Southeast Asia. And you guys like check the box, right?
Yeah.
And that's pure like looking at the macro dynamics of Southeast Asia over the next 5 to 10 years and saying, okay, rising population, rising middle class, increasing adoption of mobile and internet technologies and digitizing of traditional businesses is going to lead to this. You've seen it in the US, you've seen it in China, the proliferance of unicorns.
Yeah.
We may be near an inflection point where we go from 10 unicorns to 100 over the next 5 years. And there's some historical basis for believing that that's going to happen. And when that happens, there's a positive flywheel that kind of drags along a lot of other startups that are going to be 100 million or 50 million or, you know, whatever it is.
And so
we're seeing that. And, you know, in our Telstra portfolio, one of them just raised 75 million Series B from Peter Thiel's fund in Bangladesh.
Wow.
And they're on track to be the first Bangladeshi unicorn. And, you know, we invested at like $2 million in 2016, 2017.
That's
and so you, we're already seeing this stuff happen in the early days. And then it's like, if you drag this out 10 years and your portfolio is big enough and quality enough, you should be able to take pretty good advantage of that. And so that's the financial use case. Now, with regards to like the ROI versus real estate, it's really hard to say, because you have the only data that I've seen that's fairly comprehensive is like Silicon Valley investments at the seed stage. Right. In Southeast Asia, you know, I don't know if there's statistically significant data. And if it is, it's outdated because things are moving so fast. Right. So I suspect return and the risk are both higher here.
Yeah. And I think the time will tell, right? Time will tell how that will evolve. But that's really good. And I think what you said before as well, which maybe is the foundation of what, you know, what you just mentioned is more on the fit that you guys have found between your LPs and what you're doing. So I think that there's such a good fit there where the expectations of the LPs are really in line with, let's say, the risks and rewards, which are happening within Accelerating Asia. So I think
One thing just to double down on that, because we actually, we engage our LPs in our program. So when we do our selection, when we get to the top 25 or so, we invite our LPs to interview the founders. And they actually become part of the investment committee. And then during the first month of each program, the LPs have exclusive access to co-invest alongside Accelerating Asia in the startups at that early round. And we hope our goal is to double the valuation in 12 months. LPs in theory have an advantage to get early access before it goes out to the general public at a larger valuation.
So that would mean that the LP is investing both through the fund and also personally into that startup, right?
A lot of them do. We have a lot of LPs who invest in like 2, 3, 4 startups every single batch.
And these are done similar tickets, like 50, 100K or?
50K, 100K. So a lot of our startups come into the program, they're raising like 300, 400, 500K. We can usually help them fill those rounds out during the program. And so dramatically speed up their access to capital, which, you know, we talked about earlier, means they get to spend more time on growing the business. And then that leads towards an easier way to raise institutional capital.
So it's so true, right? I think when you fundraise, and it's been said so many times, when we were fundraising, it's the same thing, man. Like, we closed Series A, and then what's next? Yeah, Series B, right? I mean, we need to focus on
it's
our
such
next
a treadmill.
What are you doing? And it can really consume so much time and energy, which you should be spending, like you said, on quality growth, like, you know, really the stickiness with your customers. And I think
that's, but at least after Series A and Series B, you can have somebody run the business while you're out doing roadshow. When you're a seed company, you're both.
Sure. Hey, Craig, coming at the final stage of the interview, I want to have two last questions. Number one is, let's say I'm going to give you now $500 million, right? And I say, Craig, you know, you've been in the region for a long time. You know the ecosystem well. What would be the three main categories that you would invest this $500 million in, and why? So what three markets or three categories would you choose?
So first of all, I tell you, I can't take $500 million because have no idea how to deploy that. 50 million, maybe I could manage somehow. Because the stage of startups that I'm a specialist in are just way too early for me to deploy that money. But I get your point. Listen, our strategy is both diversification through a large number of investments, but also using the power law to double and triple down on the ones that we think have the best chance to succeed. We don't have a strict lens with something like a specific vertical or, you know, a thing like, obviously we take into account like dynamics, like, you know, COVID has made things very different, and rapid adoption of things like medtech, edtech, e-commerce are more interesting to us than they may have been a few years ago. And then embedded fintech, everyone is launching fintech now. And so, and it's very sexy up the chain. So part of our consideration when we invest, so we partner with VCs to come in and our startups pitch to them in private sessions. And so we work with Sequoia and Vulcan and GGV and Golden Gate, and all these VCs come in and pitch to us. And part of what we do is we say, what are they looking for? And then we can source product that's more likely to get that follow-on investment
Yeah.
And by the way, they have a lot more resources and they have a lot of data analysts and they're doing all this research. And so, we kind of use that intelligence to help us direct what it is. So there's a little bit of vertical leaning on the scales for certain things like the ones I just mentioned. Then there's geographical. So we love Indonesia. I would love to have more Indonesian exposure. And so we do have a focus there because the macro dynamics are so interesting. You know, GDP, government support, rapid adoption of technologies, growing middle class. The rails are so much better with payments and logistics and all that stuff. Like we're very passionate about that. Bangladesh is very similar, maybe 5 or 7 years behind Indonesia, but very similar dynamics. And we see Bangladesh becoming an Indonesia of the subcontinent. And so we're very interested in those geographies. And so, maybe I'll stop there, but those are just some thoughts on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, don't give me 500 million. I just need 50.
I'll rephrase it then next time. Oh, no, but that's definitely a good one. And it's interesting to see, because I hear more and more coming from Bangladesh as well, and to see those parallels just geographically and demographic wise, you see the same trends happening as well, because I think the discussion has been the same for, let's say, what happened in China versus what's going to happen in Southeast Asia, that type of discussion. So that's super exciting.
And that's another dynamic we're benefiting from is the transition of people's focus from China to other markets, especially Southeast Asia. And so a lot of our LP conversations are like, hey, we were in the US, then we were in China, a little bit in India. Now we're really looking at Southeast Asia.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so exciting times ahead, right? Exciting times ahead for the region. That's really amazing. Okay, Greg, we come to the final question. And for this final question, I want you to just imagine a day in time far, far, far away into the future, right? And on this day, I tried to Google Accelerating Asia. I see a blank page. I tried to look you up on LinkedIn. There's no profile there. I tried to Google your name, right? Greg Dixon. And there's nothing except 3 bullet points. And these 3 bullet points are the life lessons that Greg Dixon wants to leave the world with. These three points are really things that he wants to be remembered by. What would those 3 points be?
Oh man, we're going really deep here.
Going deep, man.
one thing I'm really passionate about, and I think founders should really take seriously, is the concept of social capital. And I have a blog coming out on this soon, but I think it's incredibly useful for founders to use this wisely, and it'll help them. And one of my taglines on my LinkedIn is be incredibly useful.
Yeah.
And by being incredibly useful, so to be incredibly useful to people builds social capital, which you can then use to get meetings with important people or get referrals and things like that. It's a currency. So be incredibly useful, maybe would kind of be the first one. The cheesy one, but it's true, or cliche, is, you know, do the right thing. I think founders are often in situations where it's tempting to take a shortcut, or it's tempting to do something that, you know, might a little bit cross the line, but you just don't want to do that because the risk is too high that it's going to cause problems. So I think, you know, do the right thing. And then the last one, you know, I don't know if this is the right one, but off the top of my head, take care of yourself. Founders and lots of people are just way too stressed. I meditate, I exercise every day. I've disabled all my notifications. I'm off social media.
Yeah.
I'm very passionate about researching like how to be happy, how to be satisfied while being productive and being a good person and adding. And I'm not there. It's a learning journey every day, and I've come a long way. But treat yourself right, and that'll let you be successful and be impactful and leave leave at least a small bit of positive change in the universe when you're gone.
I love it, man. I love it. As long as we kind of like manage our internal game, right? And we have that in proper gear, then the output would also be good for the planet. Craig, thank you so much, man. I really appreciated us connecting and really appreciate the conversation. Learned a lot. Accelerating Asia, guys. Fund number 2 is up and running. If you are an amazing startup that wants to change the world, check it out, acceleratingasia.com. And who knows, you know, who knows the next cohort is going to be you. Greg, thanks so much, man. And I hope to see you soon in Bali or in Singapore. We'll talk soon.
I'm going to surf forward. Yeah, thanks
bye-bye.
A lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, then please share this with a friend that you think would be inspired. Also, make sure to subscribe to the Manage the Cash Flow podcast over on Apple and Spotify. And I'd really appreciate if you can leave a rating and review on Apple and let me know what your biggest takeaway is of this episode. I want to leave you with this final thought. My mentor once told me, rejection is the first thing you learn in entrepreneurship. And I truly believe that how you handle rejections will determine how high you will go. Thank you so much for spending time with me today, and I hope to see you in the next episode.